Hey, what's up?
Yeah, who's with the microphone?
This is Brian Scull, the musical movie critic. To my right,
Dave.
To his right,
Ronnie. We're all on a first name basis here.
And to his right is a special guest to First Yahoo's. First Yahoo's with microphone commentary. He's a good friend of ours. We saw the movie for the first time with him. Day before it opened, officially opened. This is Michael Collis. Hey, I'm Mike.
Hello, Mike.
And we're here to talk about AI, artificial intelligence.
This is such a cool title, by the way.
Arguably the most polarizing film of Steven Spielberg's career. I don't think too many people are going to disagree with me on that, but that's what we're here for the next 2 hours and plus. Right away, we have the...
Ben Kingsley voiceover,
which seems a bit frivolous and a bit unnecessary at first, but later in the movie, as I'll discuss, you start to see what the form of the storytelling is as a result of having Ben Kingsley do this. And this is basically just to set up what the world is like. Polar ice caps have melted, global warming, the political, social environment. And right now we're about to see William Hurt as Professor Poppy, or as I believe was called in the treatment, the visionary.
That's the bird that David says he sees when he, or his first visual memory, anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And that was something that I actually was able to realize right around like the second or third viewing I had of this movie. I didn't notice that's the bird he's drawing in his bedroom later on with Martin.
Mm-hmm. It's also a good hint towards what we see later in the film in the third act. Right here we get the first demonstration of how advanced the artificial intelligence of the time in this movie has been. And I know something very strange and interesting when I saw this recently. The robot we are looking at, Sheila, the demo robot, actually bears a striking resemblance to Monica, the mother to David.
Do you think that?
Yeah. Ooh. Yeah. I mean, look at her face next time she gets a close-up, and you'll notice there's a bit of a similarity. I mean, it's not the same actress, but
obviously
there's a similarity to that. And there's another instance later where we see someone who looks similar, and sort of a hint of a running digital theme that sort of pays homage to Stanley Kubrick's 2001, which is not too surprising because
that's
of
a
the
wicked
fact
effect
that
right there.
Yeah,
that's a wicked.
And you see on the DVD extras, this is, by the way, one of I think the best DVDs that's been produced. Certainly, probably one of the best Spielberg's done. Where they tell you how they did that effect, and it's actually kind of cool.
Mm-hmm. What was everyone's general reaction when they first saw it? I mean, mine was just very mixed feelings. I mean, I wanted to see it. Just like this movie had a fairly big opening weekend.
Mm-hmm.
It eventually reached the 100 million mark, but didn't go
actually,
much.
Actually, no, it didn't.
Did it not?
In the U.S.,
I
it made
really
about
did
75 or so.
Oh, okay.
Overseas, it made about 150, I think, but in the U.S., it only made about 75 million, which...
Forgive me for not being as familiar with that information.
Is a disappointment, certainly for Spielberg, and certainly for the fact that this cost about 90 million, I believe, but... It made its money back, obviously, overseas and what have you.
But my general initial first reaction was just very mixed, and I wasn't entirely sure what kind of movie this was supposed to be, and at times I didn't feel as if, you know, as dead on as these filmmakers, you know, Kathleen Kennedy, Spielberg, and so forth, you know, as dead on as these filmmakers usually are and can be and have known for being, I wasn't entirely sure that they knew what kind of movie it was supposed to be. I mean, obviously they had a very clear vision, and but at the same time, it doesn't feel as if the three separate acts are organically connected as they should have been.
No, that is a problem, and that is one that I was going to wait for later to bring up. But yes, the structure of this movie is not exactly... it's not solid by any stretch of the imagination. I mean, anybody... I'd be very surprised if you could find anybody who really believed that this was a well-constructed movie from that, from a structure standpoint. It is very choppy. It's also somewhat of an homage to 2001. I mean, 2001 does come a bit more organic in terms of the storytelling is concerned. But, you know, overall, my feeling, and I'll be basically repeating this throughout the entire commentary track, that this movie struck me on an incredibly personal level. It's one of my 5 all-time favorite movies ever. Mm-hmm. My favorite film of Spielberg's. It's
definitely raising the most questions out of all of his films.
Yeah.
No, that's definitely.
It's something that really strikes me as quite visionary and quite...
This is
quite powerful.
This piece of scoring right here by John Williams reminds me a little bit of some of James Horner's work on Aliens. Does it not strike anyone else that way?
I haven't seen Aliens or heard Horner score in a while. I mean, there are those similarities. The obvious reference to people who are familiar with this film's history and familiar with the fact that this was originally a Stanley Kubrick project. He started the project. This scoring is very much a reference to a piece he uses in the in 2001 Space Odyssey, Guy in Ballet Suite.
My Tchaikovsky?
No.
Oh.
Shaka Churian. I'm sorry.
Russian class.
Yeah. I apologize, classical music fans. But yes, when we first see Discovery One in 2001, that is a very similar piece of music that's playing to what Williams composed. It's an obvious homage. Very beautiful, though. This is, I think, probably one of Williams' finest works. If it's a bit...
it's the most challenging, anyway.
It is the most challenging.
Mm.
It really is a unique...
I'm wondering if even though the score was nominated for an Oscar, if it was criticized for being just as choppy as the movie was, seeing as how the mood of the score changes just as much as the mood of the film does.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering if that was a question that was raised of whether or not the score was actually up to snuff or not.
Well, I certainly, when I first reviewed the movie, I certainly called it the most schizoid score I'd ever heard.
Mm-hmm.
But anybody who's ever heard the soundtrack to 2001 and seen the movie knows just how that is as daring a mixture of styles as this is.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this probably a little more so, because there are some cases that I really don't think John Williams could have done his best on, admittedly. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not a perfect score, just like the movie is not a perfect movie.
Yeah, without question, my favorite score of his from 2001 was probably Sorcerer's Stone, but
mm-hmm.
that's a whole different
movie. Yeah. And we're not talking about the movie too much here because of the fact that it's all pretty self-explanatory.
It is.
There's not really a whole lot to say. And
William
no,
Hurt
actually,
as
this,
Professor Hobby.
Yeah.
We haven't pointed out.
Yeah. Francis O'Connor, who is who was best known, at least I think, for her work in a couple little independent films.
And he's actually English.
Love and Other Consequences and Kiss or Kill, which I've seen was actually quite taken by her work in those films.
This is a good entrance right here.
Yeah.
Mr. Osment.
Haley Joel Osment. The great Haley Joel Osment.
Yeah, I like the way that camera shot was.
Mm-hmm.
It shows the mystery that she has.
Yeah.
Can't believe it.
Mm-hmm. Very much the look of David in that shot is very much inspired by Close Encounters, the look
very
of the
haunting.
And this, at least this first section here, I think is probably William's most assured scoring in this entire movie. And probably the best directing in terms of Spielberg's concerned. I mean, this is something that's very, a lot of people, myself included, really found this very reminiscent of Kubrick. In terms of his style, it's kind of cold in the sense of the way it looks. It's very, there are no really warm colors or anything.
No, there aren't.
I mean, you have the backlighting and cinematography by Janusz Kaminski, which is quite beautiful, and that goes throughout the entire film, I think, but it's a very cold and sterile environment, which anybody who knows Kubrick and 2001, if you can't tell, that movie is going to be brought up a lot. not undeservingly so, either.
Dark City.
Sorry.
But,
sorry.
Anyway. There. Don't know quite how to follow that up.
How do you, Brian, I was interested, this is just another movie, or another music trivia sort of thing, but that particular sound, I know I asked about how a couple of sounds are made on the E.T. score, but this particular one, it sounds almost like a music box, and I know it's not that, it sounds as if it's, is it kind of like a xylophone on a synthesizer, or...
What, the bum 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 bum?
Yeah, I think that's that.
I mean, it's basically an arpeggiated passage,
mm-hmm.
is essentially what it is. It's very reminiscent of Philip Glass.
Mm-hmm.
This is very minimal. It's
an interesting piece of scoring.
It's a little
reminiscent of Sorcerer's Stone.
I mean, an orchestra can play it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, an orchestra or a pianist, which we'll hear.
It sounds a little synthesized, but that's just me.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure some synthesized, you know, accompaniment to it. You know, probably, like you said, xylophone or maybe Glockenspiel.
It's a bit reminiscent of the Harry Potter score, but
yeah, even though this one came first.
Yeah,
but
it's definitely nothing along the lines of repetition or. Or as we've called it before, you know, Hornerism. But
right. I mean, it's not really anything we've heard from Williams before.
Mm-hmm.
Although it is somewhat reminiscent of E.T.
Mm-hmm.
But it's basically sort of Williams' interpretation of a minimalistic aesthetic, musically.
Very childlike.
Yeah.
Guy has guts bringing this kid home talking to his wife.
Well, I mean,
Mike being the only married one here knows all about that. Mike knows all about the keeping something from the wonderment of keeping.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, Brian, I had a question for you.
Yes.
Something that I couldn't really discern online. How much is Kubrick? How much is Spielberg?
Well, you can almost.
I mean,
you can almost point out, like right here, I'm about to point out a very Kubrick moment here.
Right. Yeah. I'm asking, you know, what's
percentage of the ideas?
Yeah, I mean,
is it
Kubrick's story, and then?
Well, I mean, Kubrick helped develop this story over a good decade or so.
This is very
The story is actually, we should say, the story
Spielberg.
Is inspired by the short story Super Toys Last All Summer Long by Brian Aldiss, mm-hmm. which was first published in 1969.
Mm-hmm.
Kubrick bought the rights to make the movie and subsequently worked with Aldiss and some other writers, namely Ian Watson, who gets screen story credit, to develop this story. A lot of the ideas, even if they don't necessarily the way Kubrick would have done them, which
right.
we don't know because of the fact that Kubrick sadly passed away before the movie was made.
Right.
A lot of the ideas I've from my understanding are rooted in Kubrick's influence.
Right.
I mean, there are some, you know, like this is there are parts in this that are. This is sort of more inspired by the. This is probably the closest part of the movie it's inspired by Super Toys.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, like the Sentinel in 2001, this was Super Toys was more of a springboard.
Right.
Or, you know, it was more of a seed that basically grew into something bigger
right,
and grander.
Right.
I mean, basically, the domestic part of this is the closest thing to all this we have in the entire movie.
Mm.
The rest of it is very much... Although, there are parts in the second act that are... were sort of explored in later all this continuations of the story, Super Toys, When Winter Comes and Super Toys and Other Seasons, which were written after Kubrick had already died. But were conceived as follow-ups to this and provide some inspiration for this movie.
Mm-hmm.
As far as what is Kubrick and what isn't, I can basically talk about when we get to each moment, but...
I can feel Kubrick throughout the entire thing. You know?
Yeah, and it was a conscious decision on Spielberg's part if you ever... heard him interviewed on this movie. I mean, he really did feel like he was paying homage
right.
to Kubrick. I mean, it's basically Kubrick as interpreted by Spielberg. But the thing is, I mean, it's not that there was one critic who called it the most schizoid movie in recent years, and it's like, I've seen worse
right.
shifts in tone.
Right.
You know, I've seen worse movies that really were worse in terms of tone, and and somebody said Spielberg taking on Kubrick was like Ron Howard finishing Apocalypse Now. It just wouldn't really make sense. It makes a lot more sense than
wow.
that does.
Right.
But nothing against Ron Howard. I think he's a fine director.
Yes.
Now, I mean, I'll basically get to what parts that I know are directly sort of Kubrick's influence on the story and what's not when they come. So, right now, we're coming up to a moment that I remember every time I saw this in theaters, I saw this, I think, 3 times in theaters. I mean, people were alternately jumped and laughed at this moment because it was just so surreal. What David does here, and Ogman really pulls it off really well.
Yeah, I mean, he does.
And to make it not being, I mean...
unintentionally funny.
Right.
Yeah, well, he's an excellent actor throughout this entire movie.
Oh, yeah.
He does extremely well.
You know, people first saw him in...
I see dead people!
Okay. Right. That was way too close to the mic.
Yes.
You didn't have to do it that close. Yeah. See, this moment when he's laughing, it's like, laugh is a considerably off kilter.
You know, it's a robot programmed to act like a child, learning to laugh like a child.
Mm-hmm.
That's
mm-hmm.
kind of like the mindset, and it's pulled off fairly decently here.
Yeah. I mean, Haley Joel Osment really had a lot of ideas as to how to play this character. I mean, he's the one who suggested to Spielberg that, well, he shouldn't blink.
Right.
Because robot wouldn't necessarily be programmed blank, and it would sort of make it a little more
creepy,
a little creepier. Yeah, thank you, Mike.
Thank you, Mike.
I was gonna say surreal, but I'd already used that word, so I didn't want to use it again. But
he's always watching you if he's not blinking.
Yeah, and it was an idea that was actually. Spielberg agreed to and liked the fact that and decided that that would be the case for all the robots that you would see in this movie.
Wow.
That they
that's
not
a
blink.
Cool bed, by the way.
Yeah.
That's a...
Originally, when Kubrick was devising, was
Kubrick.
Conceiving this movie in 1993, one of the choices... reportedly that would be playing David was Joseph Mazzello, who was just in Jurassic Park.
Oh.
Spielberg. And he would have been a good choice, actually. Yeah. He's a very good actor from what I've seen him in. Obviously, now he'd be too old to play this character. Who
yeah,
actually
why he wasn't nominated for an Oscar for his 2 minutes in The Lost World, I mean, I will never know.
I was thinking more along the lines of The River Wild and
oh,
Simon Birch,
well, you know.
Which he was the best part of that movie, but anyway.
But the 2 minutes he was in Lost World, though, I mean, just compelling, compelling stuff, you know what I mean?
Anyway.
See, well, at least we're using the system, though.
And another idea that Haley Joel Osment had in playing this character was... he would always turn corners the right way, you know, the same way, the exact same amount of steps, and it would be all very robotic. And I mean, the idea is this character, you know, obviously is a robot who eventually grows more humane as the movie goes on. Yes, Ron?
I just really enjoyed watching the change in the way his facial expressions are, you know,
mm-hmm.
like it's very, very subtle, but if you watch his eyes and the way he's looking at Monica
mm-hmm.
throughout this entire scene as she's reading off the imprint code to David, you can just watch the very subtle change in the way he's looking at her, and it goes from, you know, just like this childlike innocence kind of thing to a very endearing kind of connection.
I wouldn't necessarily say childlike innocence. I would say,
well, you know, kind
of
like
it's more of
like I was saying earlier, it's
more of an artificial look he gives.
Well,
he's giving at first, and then it grows into.
Well, that's what I was saying. Mentioning earlier is what was really interesting about the complexity of his performance is that at the very beginning, he's a robot programmed to act like a child who's learning to be more childlike, kind of like
yeah.
you know just, and you know that's so complex that I can't even fathom,
mm-hmm.
you know, having that kind of responsibility to be able to. Pull off a performance like that. That's
mm-hmm.
just part of the miracle of this particular performance.
Yeah. I mean, you know, Haley Joel Osment, I mean, he was a natural
yeah.
choice for this. I mean,
and,
you know,
he was
a natural choice, especially after the Sixth Sense, which is one of the finest child performances I've ever seen.
Was he not the reason that Spielberg ended up not optioning to do... Sorcerer's Stone because Spielberg was only able to see Haley Joel Osment as Harry Potter.
Oh, wow.
Well, he didn't necessarily agree with the idea of having an all-British cast.
Mm-hmm.
And specifically, yes, I believe it was the fact that that would exclude Haley Joel Osment. That was the reason.
It would exclude Haley Joel Osment.
Yeah.
Because he's not British.
No.
That much I do know.
And anyway, I should point out Frances O'Connor really this
who is English
a, who is English
who is
has a thankless role here. Really does have a thankless role in this movie, and it's a very difficult role. It's a surprisingly difficult role in the fact that, I mean, here she's playing a character who has to go from essentially being in a state of emotional inertia, I hope that doesn't sound too pretentious, to just being very angry at her husband for giving her David, to sort of being affectionate towards David, and actually from going from anger and then to parent, sort of
nurturing.
I wasn't exactly going to say that. I was sort of in uneasiness about David, and then going to a more nurturing idea, and then finally having to give him up as if to lose another one for another child.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a very tricky role
that's
what
a
she
lot
has
to
play.
That's a lot
and
to pull off.
She really pulls it off quite beautifully. I mean, she makes you buy it, I think.
Stan Winston makeup is very influential.
Yeah,
Especially you know later on it gets more and more becomes more and more a part of the story. But like just at the very beginning, when you're only looking at, when you're only watching the character of David, and you're looking at you know his skin tone and his and just the way he looks in general. I mean that's just. It's just phenomenal that you know he looks real, but he you know he isn't. It's again it goes into like how complex of a character David is.
Although you know I'm not so
real,
sure
but not
how
real.
Much.
How much
Sam Winston had to do with.
Well, he had more to do with I think the physical
with
effects.
David or Jude Law's character. I think that was more. Vineal, the key makeup artist, had to do with them because of the fact that, I mean, they're the more organic makeup effects. I mean, they're the more subtle makeup effects. And here we have the introduction of Teddy, which, despite what some reviewers said, it was not a Spielberg concoction, was in the original Super Toys story.
Wow, and I thought that would have been all Spielberg.
No, it is essentially Teddy in the Super Toys book stories. He is basically like sort of like David's best friend. He is sort of you know they mess around with each other all the time and stuff like that. And one of the key differences between Super Toys and this is the fact that. There's not a knowledge between David and Teddy that they are machines. They're not. That is left uncertain for most of those stories. And to some people, the idea of David and Teddy knowing that they're machines is, you know, it's a change that, you know, some people disagree with, a lot of people disagree with. I personally like it because I think it works for the story that they wanted to tell.
Mm-hmm.
But,
because when,
I can see how somebody could prefer the short story, which is actually quite beautiful and quite haunting piece of science fiction. Yes.
Because when, I think it works for the movie, just because... it gives it more of an emotional depth, you know, especially when David's left all alone. He doesn't necessarily understand it all that much, you know, and he would have understood it more if he knew for a fact that he was in fact a piece of artificial intelligence.
Yeah,
you know, and the fact that when he's left alone, it's much more emotional because he doesn't understand.
Yeah,
and that drives the story of the film anyway. Mm-hmm. That's what drives the story of the movie.
Yeah, I mean I'm one of those people who I can accept the change and I like the change because it does work within the story, because this story is more of a fairy tale. We'll obviously talk about the obvious
Pinocchio influence,
which is not in the oldest story, but.
pretty advanced.
Yeah,
story,
I mean, but I mean, the all this story is, if you haven't read it and you've seen the movie and you're a fan of the movie, I do highly recommend it. It's a great piece of science fiction, and it's a very compelling variation on the same story, even though this was it was the genesis of this story. It's a very good, very good story. Highly recommend it. this always got.
This is probably the one part that I genuinely laughed in the theater. I think I do.
Get me out of here.
Yeah. They're torturing you, Teddy. Now he's just old, stupid.
Yeah, Martin, played by Jake Thomas. This is another big difference in the all this story. Monica and Henry do not have a son in the original story. They are one of these people who, as established in the prologue, are waiting for a license to be able to have a child. And that's the reason they have David in the short story. So, significant difference in that actually, in the way all this continued the story in Super Toys, when winter comes, it grows, it makes it infinitely sadder what happens in the stories. But here it's a nice little touch to have him already have a son that is cured miraculously because of the fact that you sort of see this antagonism that Martin has towards David. He's almost sort of jealous of David. Some people think David is jealous of Martin, and I can kind of see that, but I don't really see it as much as some people.
I don't necessarily see that.
I think that David is more sort of confused about it.
Yeah, he doesn't understand. I don't think he understands Martin's intentions here.
He's basically going along with it because Martin's manipulating him to basically try to get him to make a mistake and not so that they would get rid of him. I really do believe that Martin is more jealous of David than the other way around.
And what's kind of a dramatic cinematic irony sort of thing is that what ultimately ends up getting David thrown out is Martin's life being endangered, which is kind of interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Cool.
This is the scene that you were talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Where are you?
Yeah, and I didn't, and I think Mike said the exact same thing, is that you didn't really realize that this was the symbol you see at the very beginning of the movie until like a couple of showings.
You see it later. Mm-hmm. Well, you see it later in the movie too.
It was just kind of neat to like realize that was the symbol that you see at the very beginning of the. The Cybertronics emblem is the bird that David describes as his very first memory.
Yeah. And one of the things that we... that is different from the short story is the fact that there is no Professor Hobby. You don't really meet the creator of David. It's basically centered around David and Teddy, Monica and Henry. Who does work for the company that makes David, but is basically sort of like their business sales representative. Mm-hmm. And you basically see the parallel stories between what's happening at home, and Henry is a person who's not out around much. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I'm just now thinking about is a clever way that they sort of acknowledge that part of the short story is in the movie is the fact that Henry does not imprint with Monica. And I mean, that has another reason, which I can go ahead and say, is because of the fact that I believe that the reason Henry brought David home was primarily for Monica's sake. Henry basically already accepted the fact that Martin was probably not going to be recovered. It was solely for David's for Monica's sake, that he brought David home, because she had not accepted that.
And what's ironic is that he's the really the first one to start doubting David's presence.
Yeah,
he's the one who had seemingly the most faith in David at first, and then he's also the first one to really start to notice that it might be questionable keeping him around.
Excuse me. And going back to what I was starting to talk about before I brought the imprinting was the fact in the short story, David does refer to Henry as daddy. You know, Monica is mommy and Henry is daddy, but he's not around. You don't really see any real interaction between Henry and David in the short stories until the very end. And I think that was nicely sort of implied, that distance between the two in this movie, by not having Henry imprint on. Like I said, I think it's more for the fact that it was more for Monica's sake than Henry's sake that he brought David into the house. Like, this is kind of a chilling scene.
There's
impressive makeup effects.
There's a couple of chilling scenes.
Well, this is a mix of both makeup and CGI, is it not?
I think so, yeah.
I wouldn't doubt it.
I wouldn't be surprised either, but I think Hobbit more has to do with makeup.
This is Stan Winston right here.
Yeah, because, I mean, this is obvious, you know, I mean, this is a fake table. I mean, Haley Joel Osment's basically sitting down at the end of this table, and this is a Stan Winston creation.
I was interested in why the cleaning process is so manual. you know, they're so advanced. But then again, I was reading a couple reviews, and some people really did like the way the future is portrayed, you know, in this movie. You know, it's not too out there, not too fantasy. You know, this, you know, you could easily see this as the direction that humanity is going right now.
Yeah.
And well, very much like Minority Report.
Yeah, very much like
Spielberg envisions the future. I mean, what he did for Minority Report, I wouldn't doubt if he did something similar with AI. Is he developed a think tank of futurists for, you know, a weekend, and they just sat around talking about how they think things are going to be in 50 or 100 years or so,
and
near distant.
I don't know that they did so much of that in AI. I know Kubrick did on 2001, which is part of the reason why that vision holds up so brilliantly now, even though we're two years past 2001. I wouldn't be, like you guys, I wouldn't be surprised if he did something similar. I just don't know that was necessarily as publicized as it was in those two movies. But yeah, the art direction by Rick Baker, inspired by concept work by Chris Baker, Rick Carter, the production designer, a longtime Spielberg collaborator. Chris Baker is the conceptual artist that Kubrick enlisted to...
Who before this had never worked on a movie.
He's a comic book artist.
Graphic novelist.
And they're...
I love that Teddy can just sew himself up.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's, you know, I think that's part of the reason they're called super toys, because they know how to fix themselves.
My Teddy Ruxpin can never do that. Anyway, I mean, my brother's Teddy Ruxpin could never do that. Yeah, I didn't have a Teddy Ruxpin.
I mean, the knowledge that Teddy here has, you know, how he seems to be like one or two steps ahead, you know, and saying, you know, don't eat that because you'll break, stuff like that. I mean, is that present in the original?
No, not really, because like I said, one of the significant differences between the
very cringe-worthy moment here,
this is the fact that neither Teddy nor David are really certain of the fact that they don't know that they're machines.
Gotcha.
For all they know, they're real. Mm-hmm. So, which makes the short story all the more poignant, but like I said, I think it works better in the context of this story that they know that they're machines.
Right.
But I think part of the reason why, I mean, you have sort of more of a knowingness in Teddy is because of the fact that he's an older robot. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's been around. I mean, you know, David is very much a new model of AI, and Teddy is more knowing of the world and the environment and the Swinton's house. Yeah, this is a pretty cringeworthy scene in itself.
It does throw, you know, the your average Joe moviegoer a little off guard. You're starting to acknowledge that this movie is going to go to some depths that you didn't think it was going to.
And some would even argue it didn't go far enough, but I think it did.
It goes just far enough. I think. I don't think it goes too far. I don't think that it doesn't go far enough, but I think it does start to throw, you know, somebody off who, you know, I don't want to refer to you know, your average moviegoer as a less intelligent moviegoer, but, you know, just someone who was expecting the next, you know, crowd pleaser from Spielberg, you know, would not.
Well, I think part of the problem with that was the marketing. I do think there was a significant problem in the way they marketed this, especially in the trailers, because some of the trailers sort of implied that this was going to be like another E.T. And I think that really, because of that, it was really threw people for a loop when they saw it. I mean, and
why it wasn't
as popular as some people were.
One of the reasons that this movie didn't find the audience that it probably should have or that it deserved.
Yeah.
I mean, I know, even after looking at the trailers, I really did not know what to expect from the movie.
Well, I mean, you know, anybody who's familiar at all with the development of this, the fact, if you knew that this was a Steven Spielberg homage to Stanley Kubrick, if you know those two sensibilities, you know that this is not going to be your typical Spielberg film. At the same time, you know it's not going to be your typical Kubrick film. And I think it finds a nice middle ground in that respect. Does it always work in that? Not necessarily, but, you know.
This is one of the creepiest scenes coming up here.
Yeah.
The scene kind of sends chills up my spine because
this isn't even the worst one either.
No, it isn't. But yeah, I almost, yeah. I almost
just get, this whole section is just.
I almost drowned in a pool when I was that old.
You can sort of see that Martin's antagonism gets considerably darker. Mm-hmm. Actually, you know, I mean, at first it's relatively harmless. I mean, him, you know, sort of goading David into actually eating food, and then you see him, you know, say, well, if you get a lock of Monica's hair,
that's,
you know,
right,
she'll love
you.
And this, yeah.
That's true.
I mean, nightmares.
I mean,
any bubbles that were.
As somebody who's.
Yeah, he's not breathing down. Has seen no bubbles.
Well, yeah, I think bubbles were. Any air bubbles might have been removed with the computer.
Well, I'm sure it was probably a dry for wet scene. You know, where it's like they do it in a dry environment, but
that's
visually
point.
Do, you know, through
that's
visual effects to make it, you know, as if he's in the bottom of the pool. I remember hearing that's how he did it. What we see coming up here is a scene directly lifted from all this. The Monica picking up the sort of messages that David is writing is a direct lifting from the All of This story. And I think the intention, the way it's portraying the book, I think is portrayed very well in the movie. A lot, there were people who would disagree with me on that, and I know there are people who disagree with me on that, but I think it's a very good portrayal, and it gets the same message across, and it sort of is kind of, it's appropriately, she reacts appropriately to it, I think, and the fact that it's like, and I think this is something that really, when she comes into the room, you know, she's resolved in the fact that she's going to take him back to Cybertronics to be destroyed. Okay. But I think this is sort of like a trigger for her to where when she does make the choice not to take him back and to just sort of abandon him, mm-hmm. I think that's something that influences that decision. Mm-hmm. At least that's my interpretation of it.
Really well acted.
Yeah. Like I said, it's thankless
role. Her character is just...
It's more of a symbolic role, if you want to look at it that way. I mean,
but her character is just as complex as David, just only in a different way.
More realistic, more...
because she's just as torn. She's just as torn emotionally as David is, but this is more maternal, obviously.
Mm-hmm. And I think one of the this is one of those movies where reading the negative reviews is actually just as interesting, if not more so, than reading the positive reviews for it, because of the fact that it's really interesting to see the way people look at this movie. And I think part of the problem I had with some of the people who reviewed this movie is that, well, I mean, you know, it doesn't explore the idea of what responsibility does a human have to a robot if the robot is programmed to love a human. They sort of miss the point of the fact that this is a fairy tale. It's the fact that he's a robot. This is not literal science fiction in any stretch of the imagination. It's more the idea. It's more using science fiction ideas as a metaphor for, you know, I mean, I sort of like look at the abandonment of David as sort of like abandoning a puppy or an animal in the woods and just leaving it there. At least that's something that I've come to believe about this film.
And I'm able to appreciate the fact that the score right here is more, you know, it's nothing elaborate or over the top or anything. It's nothing that's trying to jerk a tear out of you. It's more or less representable of the mind games that's kind of going on here. It's the emotional tearing of each character is going through.
And more inappropriately, it's very reminiscent of E.T.
Mm-hmm.
in this aspect.
Well, I think the score for E.T. did more or less go for the throat, you know, emotionally. I think this score, in a way, does kind of toy with your emotions, but more on a subconscious level than it does consciously. I don't know if that makes any sense to anyone, but you know, it's more of a subconscious kind of message that, you know, we were talking about forced sentiment on the E.T. commentary, and I do feel as if the sentiment is a little forced in this film at times. but not necessarily because of Williams' score, which mm-hmm. is 90% of the reason that you should feel a certain emotion in a film. I think it's more or less through the storytelling that the emotion is the sentiment is forced. The score is really more or less a subconscious kind of score, I think, and it really does play with your emotions on a I don't mean to repeat myself, even though I'm going to, subconscious level.
Well, I mean, it does more, it's more of a traditional idea of what a score is supposed to do, where it underlines what we're seeing as opposed to enforces it.
Mm-hmm.
It's more of a classical or classic sense of what film scoring was.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, again, I said I would mention it a lot. 2001, very much inspired, I think, Williams' score, because if you listen to the soundtrack in 2001, it's very different styles in terms of the use of the way the different classical music does. Talking about forced sentiment, this I know you don't agree with this.
This right here, this scene here does really, go for the goal, you know. But I wasn't talking about this as much.
I didn't think you were.
This scene did, and still does move me,
mm-hmm.
and I'm still, you know, very, you know.
Yeah.
But I'm referring to a little bit later in the film.
I know.
But we'll get to that.
Yeah, I like it because of the fact that you sort of see the dilemma from both points of view.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
You understand David's point, dilemma. You understand David's response to her abandonment, and yet you also see Monica's dilemma in.
Because we were all 12 years old at one point, and we know exactly how we would feel if we were mm-hmm. abandoned in the woods by our mom, for crying out loud, when we're, you know, we. I mean, that's a feeling that hits home with everyone.
Mm-hmm.
I would think, you know, that's nothing that's gonna, you know,
yeah,
that's nobody's gonna question, you know, the motivation of each of the character, David. Nobody's gonna question that.
And right now we just hit Act Two with the introduction of Gigolo Joe, played
by Beautifully.
I mean, this is a tour de force. Really believe so. I mean, this. How he didn't get nominated for Best Supporting Actor for this is beyond me, because he was just absolutely phenomenal in this movie.
He's working a mojo.
He was nominated for Talented Mr. Ripley, and I think that was a big part of the reason Spielberg cast him in this movie. I really believe that, because that character playing this is every bit as charismatic as this one.
Mm-hmm.
And
It's very much under the radar as well. It's very much under the radar charisma, which is something I admire about it.
Mm-hmm. I really like the fact that, I mean, you know, he's just yeah. Some people would question the sort of style of music that he's
given, but it's great.
It's hilarious.
Right. It's great comic relief.
Yeah, and I really do believe that this is the type of music Kubrick would have selected for this character. This was a Kubrick creation.
Mm-hmm.
The idea of Gigolo Joe.
Oh, man.
This was not in the short story.
Right.
Is basically what I'm saying.
Right.
And the fact of the matter is that he's a romantic.
Yeah.
He's a hopeless
romantic.
He's not Deuce Bigelow. He's mm-hmm. you know
Deuce.
Well, somebody was gonna mention that.
God.
Somebody was gonna mention Deuce Bigelow. No. I figured it might as well be me.
No.
I'm sorry.
What I was gonna mention was the fact that you know, whenever you think about people making robots essentially for sex, you know, mm-hmm. you're always thinking about, you know, the male point of view, having, you know, four or five robot girls looking you up. But I thought it was interesting that...
Yeah, like Fembots in the Austin Powers movie.
Exactly. That's almost at the Deuce Bigelow level there, right? But, you know, I found it interesting that they decided to feature first and show almost all the time the male gigolo.
Right. Yeah. The female's version of an ideal lover mecha, which is really interesting.
We just saw a little homage on part of Jude Law to Gene Kelly and Singing in the Rain with him doing the little dancing there.
Mm-hmm.
And what I love about Jude Law's performance, and I mean, you really could, you could compare the way he plays this character to the likes of Cary Grant and, you know, the old-fashioned movie stars.
Right.
And I don't think too many people would smack you around a bit. This was a really cool effect, what we're about to see right here.
Or the commentary isn't exactly in sync with the movie that you're watching right now, the effect that you just saw.
Yeah.
Anyway.
He's just got a swagger to him that is just excellent.
But then the gasp from, I remember the gasp from the audience when we realized what's happened here.
Yeah. And this was the other moment that I was bringing up, that the, you'll notice, you, or you may not notice, that the actress who plays Samantha, I don't know who she is, but I mean, if you look at the face on Samantha, again, sort of reminiscent of Monica.
Mm-hmm.
And I think part of the reason, I think, you know, whether they intended to or not, my interpretation of it is, I mean, you basically have this ideal female in Monica that is sort of established by Frances O'Connor's performance. And you, by having the original robot that we see in the beginning resemble her, and the character that essentially starts Gigolo Joe's story arc, you know, the fact that he's got basically get out of town.
Yeah.
By having those two resemble Monica, I think it's sort of an idea that this one, sort of, I guess you could say, ideal woman, if you want to put it that way.
This is a very surreal moment.
Is the, is, she's basically the person that sets this all in motion. This movie in motion sets the stories in motion.
Mm-hmm.